Welcome to podcast number 5 on Radio Salam Shalom, the podcast for mid-November, with me, Peter Brill.
And myself, Shabana Gorsad.
So welcome to the mid-November podcast for Radio Salam Shalom. I'm Peter Brill.
And the son of Shabana Gorsad.
It's actually the Shabs and Peas show this time.
Yes, I like what you've done there.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we like to be a little creative. You're probably listening in all kinds of places, on your bike and in the bath. We promise we'll cover our eyes to keep your modesty. But you could be listening anywhere, not just in different places, but in different places around the world. And if you want to catch up with this podcast and others, it's podcasts@salamshalom.org.uk.
Indeed, that's a genius of podcasts and internet. So we hope you're going to enjoy the show wherever you are.
Well, we've got quite a packed show tonight. We've got something from somebody's living room, we've got something from the stage, we've got some expertise on autism, and we're also talking to a Holocaust survivor, not just about her experiences during the war, but also her experiences in the Middle East subsequently.
Exactly, I'm really looking forward to that one actually, it should be really interesting. And along with all of that, we've also got a special interview celebrating International Tolerance Day with Lawrence Kay, and we also have, surprise, surprise, somebody covering the election of Barack Obama to the White House. So seriously, guys, you're in for a bit of a treat this week, I reckon.
I don't think we want to let our political slip show, but I think it's been a fairly impressive and momentous week all round with the American elections. And, of course, on the downside, what's been going on in the UK with the financial markets. So there's plenty to talk about there as well, I think.
Yes, there is. But before we kick it all off, I have to ask you one question, Peter.
Go on.
One quick one. Do you think that the White House is going to be painted black?
Do I think it's going to be painted black? I think that's possibly one step too far, but I think the fact that we have the first ever African-American president is an enormous step forward, not just in American politics, but I think in world politics. It's fantastic news, so a lot, I think, to celebrate there.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to look at American history and look at the struggle of African-Americans to think that this seriously is such an amazing step in the right direction for them. So big thumbs up. Let's just hope that Barack Obama, you know, does some good.
I think he's got a lot to do, and I think that he's coming into a situation that's going to take a lot of work to try and stabilize, and that's not just worldwide, but obviously in America itself, and a lot of challenges faced. I think that would be the case of any president that came in, whether it had been McCain or Obama. So, yeah, a lot to do, but it'll be interesting. The first 100 days apparently are the ones where he can make the big difference.
So watch this space, and fingers crossed. Good luck. I'm kind of rooting for him. What about you?
I think we're rooting for him.
We are. I think the whole world really is, except for some people who might not be, but still, most of us are.
Everybody has their political views, but I think the important thing is that it is a chance, as he has said, for change, and it remains to be seen whether it will be changed for better or for worse. But whatever happens, I think he needs an awful lot of luck.
Yeah, and the UK is not too far behind, because apparently we're considering having a black Doctor Who.
Well, that's a step in the right direction.
I think it's the same, really. I mean, Doctor Who in himself, you know.
And President of the United States. Yeah, I mean, there are big revolutions coming, clearly. Black Doctor Who's a big deal. I have to say, I've got real problems here, because I'm a huge David Tennant fan, and I think he was the best ever Doctor. For those of you who don't know who Doctor Who is, I mean, I can't believe that anyone around the world wouldn't know, but for those of you who don't know who Doctor Who is, it is a massive long-running television program, which theoretically is a kids' program about a doctor who's actually a time traveler. But actually, it's not a kids' program at all, really, is it?
Maybe.
I think it's wonderful, and the current Doctor, who sort of changes every now and then, has been a British actor called David Tennant, who amazingly has got this fantastic English accent, but is in fact Scottish, and broad Scottish.
Wow.
And has just been the most brilliant, I think, of all the Doctors. But he's now decided he's going to leave, so we move on. Let's go into somebody's living room,
Indeed.
Let's do that.
This is the first clip we're playing for you guys. It's Living Room Dialogues with Len and Libby Troutman. It should be really interesting. Basically, they are a retired American couple doing their bit to bring Jewish and Palestinian communities members together. From their home on the US West Coast, exclusively on Radio Salam Shalom, they share six stories of Muslim and Jewish cooperation from all around the world. So this should be pretty interesting. We'll see you on the other side.
Well, hello again to you at Radio Salam Shalom from the West Coast of the United States here in the San Francisco Peninsula. This is Len Trobman.
And this is Libby Trobman, and we're going to be meeting for the 198th time with our Jewish-Palestinian Living Room Dialogue Group.
And we thought that before we do that, we'd send you a message and give you some of the good news of human successes about Palestinian, Israeli, Jewish, Muslim, Christian relationship building that's going on around the world. And you can get these stories by simply Googling Jewish-Palestinian success. And the first one is about stories that remember Abraham's insight of oneness and that it's being lived out by Muslims and Christians and Jews and others. And we started out the message by reminding ourselves of Abraham's primitive, intuitive insight a long time ago about the oneness of humankind and life. Wahad, Echad, one. And that we're learning more about and becoming more as neighbors forever and exhibiting what one really means in real life. And we remember that Galileo, the scientist, showed us that we're not the center, but we're part of a larger interconnected one universe. And then Einstein came into the picture and revealed how life and time and space are one and interrelated. And then on the inner dimension, Carl Jung, the psychologist, illustrated how our psyches, our innermost dreams and symbols are similar and not dissimilar. Again, one. And Joseph Campbell, who told us a lot about mythology. Myths, of course, may not have happened, but they're true. And they tell us profound wisdom about how to live our lives. And that the mythology and all the cultures are really quite similar in their themes. And finally, recent genographic studies of our DNA show that humankind's journey by foot across the earth really comes out of, we all walked out of Northeast Africa about 20, 30, maybe 40,000 years ago, and we're really one family. And 2 years, I remember, Libby, 2 years after our first child was born, we saw that photograph of Earth from space. Mm-hmm. And we remembered Sir Fred Doyle's insight from the UK. And he said, once a photograph of the Earth taken from outside is available, a new idea as powerful as any in history will be let loose. So it was another way to say that there's really no individual survival. So it's exciting that Radio Salam Shalom is on the air, that you're leading the way in broadcasting of Muslims and Jews speaking and listening and reaching out to the world together on the internet. So here are six stories of contemporary cultural explorers and connectors, healers, creators of new life on earth that we'd like to share with you, and again that you can find on our website.
All right, so here's a nice story that's comes from Reston, Virginia. And it involves the Al Dulles Area Muslim Society. They call themselves Adams. And they have their weekly prayer services in a United Christian parish, which kind of outgrew itself. And so they were given a new facility where they could hold their weekly prayer services in a Jewish synagogue. So to thank both the United Christian parish and the new synagogue allowing them to hold their prayer services, they have been given awards to commemorate their generosity and their openness to letting Muslims pray in these other different religious facilities.
So then in the Chicago Tribune a couple months ago, the headline said, Muslim and Jewish students win advanced degrees from Catholic Union. Two teachers become the first female and first Muslim female and first Jewish female to receive advanced degrees from the Catholic Theological Union. And it tells about Jewish Sarah Beer, who traveled from Chicago to Israel to learn more about Judaism, but her journey to the Holy Land was marred by the religious violence there from the beginning to the end. And ultimately it led her to explore other faiths as well. And Similarly, Siafa Almirzana from Indonesia experienced growing tensions among the Muslims in her own Indonesia that threatened formerly healthy relationships with the Christian and Jewish minority, and it led her to pursue parallel studies with her Jewish partner there. And it was a great example of a Christian institution giving desperately needed help to people who can say that we can live together and show mutual respect in a pluralistic way, like Sarah and Siafa are doing.
Another inspiring story comes from the UK. Alif Aleph is a group of British Muslims and British Jews who have been coming together since 2003 to build bridges between their two communities. And their schools linking programs were launched in September of 2007 and has been very successful building bridges, initiating activities between the Jewish and the Muslim students there in London. It did begin with more than 100 students from 7 Muslim and Jewish schools in London, and they came together for a series of groundbreaking curriculum-based workshops and field trips. And the students engaged in activities that helped correct the misunderstandings and fears and projections that they had between the different faith groups, and they were able to build these new friendships.
I think you should be telling the next one, Libby, but then that's a stereotype. And this is a wonderful headline from the International Herald Tribune, Building Peace Between Jews and Muslims, One Pastry at a Time. I'm not really allowed in the kitchen much here, so this is
my
chance.
No, this is good. It might inspire you to do that.
So in Paris, there's a corps of about 50 women who call themselves peace builders. And they are providing a neutral space for women who want to engage and discover one another's humanity and their recipes, and they're cooking together, and they just do not want to continue fruitlessly pitting the Jewish and Muslim communities against each other. And after 6 years, Peace Builders counts in among their participants about 200 of them, and they're sharing their cultures and their personal lives at major Arab and Jewish institutions. They're running seminars there in Paris. They're attending conferences in Brussels, and they're campaigning for a plaque to put on the Grand Mosque of Paris, and that would commemorate the Jews who were saved by the Muslims during World War II. And what they're doing is very courageous.
Then I have one more story, and I'm happy to share this one because we happen to know the people that was written about in a blog called Read the Spirit by a blogger named David Crum. And it has to do with a Muslim leader, Victor Begg, who lives in Detroit, and a Jewish peace activist, Brenda Rosenberg, who has been doing wonderful things to bring diverse, previously alienated citizens together to begin to understand each other and cooperate in new kinds of wonderful programs and projects. And on David Crum's blog, he describes how almost every day, Brenda Rosenberg, around 9 o'clock in the morning, calls her good friend Victor Begg, and they both are married to, they each have their own families and spouses, but they have this wonderful working friendship, and so she calls him each morning to check in and see what the plans are for the day and how things are going. And to show how this is inspiring, David Crum, who wrote the story on his blog, says now when he's up at 9 o'clock in the morning, he can't help thinking about Brenda, who's calling her friend Victor, and it helps him feel that he's not alone in his own peace activities and works, and he knows that other people out there are reaching out to each other and working together to create something really wonderful and new.
I remember, Libby, when we saw Victor and Brenda at last year's Islamic Society of North America meeting, and we were there among 40,000 Muslims. It was a very new experience for us, and it was fantastic. And that's just before we went on to Washington, D.C. to be at the Hillel conference called Imagining a More Civil Society, talking about Muslim-Jewish relationship building in that community as well. So our sixth and last story for you at Radio Salam Shalom is in Jewish News newspaper of Northern California here, and it's called Finding Common Ground. There's a gorgeous color photograph on the cover page of the Jewish newspaper here of hands, young hands in a circle. And it's Jewish and Palestinian students returning from the Balkans with a better understanding of peace and their relationship with one another. It's sponsored by Abraham's Vision, a local San Francisco Bay Area-based group of that brings youth together to engage one another. And they had, from around the world, and they had a real eye-opening, transformative experience there in the Balkans, seeing that their own relationships and conflicts were not the only ones that were challenged in the world. And they're not finished learning yet, because they're going to get back together in West Virginia and then go out and speak to larger audiences about their experiences. One of the inspiring aspects of Abraham's Vision is their co-directors are, in fact, a Muslim Palestinian and a Jew. And Huda Abu Arkub, her story is amazing. She's from a Muslim home in Hebron. And Huda, after helping raise her 11 siblings in Hebron and the West Bank in Palestine, became a Fulbright scholar in conflict transformation, is now shepherding the young adults in Abraham's Vision. And her partner, shoulder to shoulder, is Aaron Han Tapper, who determinatively, in his early part of his life, participated in many of the U.S. peace-building camps, like Seeds of Peace and others, face-to-face, faith-to-faith, and building bridges for peace. There are a dozen of those camp programs now in North America. And then he went on to study and become a scholar of excellence in comparative religions and on the road to inventing and fulfilling Abraham's Vision. It's a great story and a great ongoing program, and that really describes and illustrates the future. So these are six of the hundreds of success stories that you can find on our website of our 16-year-old Jewish-Palestinian Living Room Dialogue. And just Google Jewish-Palestinian success. Or if you'd like to see the record of our own dialogue's history, you can Google Jewish-Palestinian progress to see several hundred examples of our own public outreach activities. And we'll be here for you. And mostly, we're just grateful for you at Radio Salam Shalom for giving the world a view of what broadcasting life can look like.
We hope you find these stories inspiring and that they may give you ideas on how you can launch your own wonderful, exciting projects and activities, bringing people together and very rewarding and fulfilling new kinds of relationships.
From the Western Rim of North America and the Jewish-Palestinian Living Room Dialogue, thank you, Radio Salam Shalom.
Bye-bye.
Jews and Muslims talking together.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.
Indeed it is. And that was the Traubens from their living room, which was pretty interesting. They will be with us again in our next podcast, and you can find out more about Libby and Len and their living room dialogues on their website, which is Traubman, which is traubman.igc.org. And note that there's no www.
Wonderful. And in fact, something you should know is that they were one of our very first ever listeners when we launched Radio Salam Shalom. They were the first people, I think, to send us an email saying, "We hear you." So they've stuck with us, which is fantastic news, and they're great people. So good news.
But it also shows how anybody could be a part of Radio Salam Shalom. So seriously, guys, if you're out there thinking, "Hey, I could do that," do it.
We want people to do it. We want people to be sending us more things that we can include in our Radio Salam Shalom podcasts.
Indeed. Okay, now we have got a special interview lined up for you guys. It is with Lawrence Kay, who is actually the chairman of the, wait for it, UK Friends of the Abraham Funds Initiative, or TAFI, which I prefer really because it's short.
But if it's TAFI, it should be Welsh, shouldn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. On the 16th of November, it is International Tolerance Day, which sort of kicks off the Tolerance and Coexistence Month in Israel. And we are very privileged to be joined, not in the studio, but on the phone, by Lawrence Kay, who will be telling us a little bit more about it. So, Lawrence, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on your show.
You're very welcome. I've kind of introduced you. Have I left out anything important?
No, that's the sort of the bare bones, and obviously I look forward to telling you more.
Well, in which case, do tell us more. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about the Friends of Abraham, the funds initiative. What's all that about?
Okay, so actually, through the idea originally, in fact, of an American, the Abraham Fund Initiatives, or TAFI, in Israel, has been working for about 20 years to promote coexistence, equality, and really more than that, a vision of a shared society amongst Israel's Arab and Jewish citizens, and of course, of Israel's Arab citizens, which are 20% of Israel's population, 20% are Muslim. The UK Friends was set up, in fact, we launched in June this year, to support TAFI's work in Israel by doing two things, by obviously raising money to support their work, and also to educate and have outreach activities here in the UK right across the communal spectrum to explain why TAFI's work is important and what makes it special. And I think what makes TAFI's work in Israel special, because there are many great coexistence projects going on in Israel, all aimed at improving relations between Israel's Arab and Jewish citizens. But what makes TAFI's work, I think, special is its strategy of advocacy through action, by which I mean that the initiatives and programs it has, and I'll give you a couple of examples in a second, are designed really as templates or as models for the government to adopt as policy. And in that way, we're working towards bringing real systemic change within Israel and the Israeli government's policy towards its Arab minority.
You're clearly working with some enormous tensions, and it must be very hard to be working with the government, persuading the government that actually they need to be working together and bringing the Arab community, the Muslim community, into, if you like, part of the political system.
That's absolutely right. This is no easy task, and nor is it something that, you know, transforms overnight. But there are some really, amongst often the doom and gloom, there are some sort of promising developments. And can I tell you a couple of them? One of the initiatives it has is the Police Community Initiative, which is really all about transforming the way Israel's police force, which is kind of operated and been seen as an extension of Israel's security, to becoming a service provider to Arab communities, the towns where Israel's Arab citizens live, to become real service providers. So, for example, through training, which the Abraham Fund does with local police commanders, we're now getting the Israeli police going into Arab towns, sitting down with the senior members of the community who themselves gather other families, listening to what their concerns are, obviously overcoming a lot of doubt, a lot of hostility, a lot of suspicion, but actually beginning to learn what is it that you as a community need, how can we as police start to provide those support services. So without trying to sort of present some sort of rosy picture, it is really working to transform attitudes and that way to transform experience on the ground.
Okay, great. Could you just tell us a little bit more about this International Tolerance Day?
It's another example, I think, how the agenda is the Israel government agenda, how the relations between Israel's Arab and Jewish citizens has become more and more important, and the government, or at least sectors of the government, should we say, realize that, you know, whether you're looking at it from a security perspective, whether you're looking at it from a moral perspective, whether you're looking at it from an economic perspective in terms of empowering Israel's Arab citizens to sort of take a more prominent and more senior role in the civil service, to be more economically productive, to empower its Arab women citizens. For all those reasons, working on improving relations and relationships between Israel's Arab Jewish citizens is becoming more and more important, and I think this is part of that process. In fact, in a week's time, we're hosting a visit by a public committee, which was actually set up by the Minister of Education, Professor Yuli Tamir, who have created a committee for national coexistence education. In other words, actually saying we need to re-engineer our education policy in this particular sphere to improve the way in which Jewish children are taught Arabic language and culture, and to look at the way in which the whole educational system needs to be changed to embed coexistence education right into the heart of it.
Do you not often feel that this is a sort of case of pushing water uphill, that really there are such fundamental changes that need to be made on both sides, in both communities? I mean, you're often meeting, as you say, suspicion and intolerance, yeah, and those tensions. Do you not often feel that you're just pushing water uphill here?
Yes and no. We don't feel like Sisyphus, the one I think he gets to the top of the hill and then he sort of he's back down the bottom again. This is kind of pushing. You know, it's if you're doing exercise in the health club and you sort of tilt the thing to an angle, it's much harder work. But you know, you still get there. I think if we're working it, we feel slow and slow, steady progress. Yes, often two steps forward, one step back, or even one step forward, two steps back. But, you know, transformation doesn't come quickly and it doesn't come easily, but it comes, and it comes about ultimately, I think, both top-down and bottom-up. You know, government policy changes, but people on the ground need to change and also demand change. And I think we see elements of that. So, you know, we're not discouraged.
Do you think that the fund is going to be funded enough for long enough to be able to implement and see that real long-term change?
Money is a challenge, especially in the current sort of economic climate, and the Abraham Fund works with, and gets funding from a number of sources, some which come from the government, some which come from Jewish organizations, some which come from non-Jewish organizations, and that undoubtedly is a struggle, which is why we have to really prioritize and work with partners and do the most we can and focus those efforts. So yes, you know, more money would be great.
As it always is. Why the UK? What do you think is so important about the UK in bringing about some of this change?
It's interesting because the Abraham Fund in Israel, I mentioned it was started actually by an American individual who had the vision back in the 80s. But we're the first, if you like, friends of the Abraham Fund, friends of TAFE outside Israel. And I think Israel looked to the UK and looked at some of the issues that we have in terms of, you know, a multicultural society, and looked also at Northern Ireland and the way in which the police force has transformed, or is in the process, should we say, of a transformation, and sees a lot of examples and a lot of issues that Israel feels it can learn from, which is why, in fact, a delegation of the senior Israeli police commanders went across the Northern Ireland to understand how, in fact, the Northern Ireland police force is itself working through a process of transformation. So I think they see a lot of things that can be learned from the UK, and, you know, we're kind of, obviously, also there's strong historical ties, so I think that's why.
One final quick question, Lawrence. If there is one thing that you could achieve over the next 6 months as the Friends of Abraham Fund, what would it be?
Within both the Jewish community and within the Muslim community and in the other communities, this topic coming towards, you know, really sort of becoming very well known, because not only is it important as an internal issue for Israel, but I think also it has repercussions in the broader Middle East. Now, we work exclusively, you know, within Israel and the issue of Arab-Jewish relations within Israel, but undoubtedly how Israel treats its own Arab citizen minority, its Palestinian citizens of Israel, is a very important element of how it's viewed by, if you like, the street in the Middle East and beyond. So I would like to see it getting towards the top of the agenda. Can I mention a couple of events we've got coming up?
Very briefly.
Okay. November the 27th, we've got an event coming up where we have a wonderful musician performing in London, Tazir Elias, who is an oud and violin virtuoso. That's at the Goodenough College. And then we have another event December the 2nd. If listeners to the podcast are interested, if they email info@abrahamfund.org.uk, they can get details. And if they'd like to get involved and help, whether it's in terms of coming to events, lending a hand, contributing funds, just drop an email to the same address. We'd be delighted to have you on board. And if you'd like to see a quick video, go to YouTube, search Abraham Fund, and you'll see a video of our launch, which also describes our work.
And we will, of course, put links on to the website as well, which is
abrahamfund.org.uk.
Lawrence Kay, Chairman of the Friends of Abraham Funds Initiative, thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
And thanks, Radio Salam Shalom, for having me on, and also for the terrific work that you do.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with your project, then.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And from the drama of the Middle East, we turn to drama of another kind. Vicky Feltham, who is one of our regular contributors, lifts the curtain on the world of drama and stage performance, and that's from members of the Jewish or Muslim communities worldwide. Now this week she's talking about comedy musical duo Good for the Jews, and also gives us a preview of a forthcoming tour from the UK's leading Muslim Jewish Christian jazz collective.
Hello, I'm Vicky Feltham, and welcome to the Stages feature. Today I'm quite excited because it should be quite an amusing section. I'm going to be talking about Good for the Jews. They are an American comic duo consisting of Rob Tannenbaum and David Fagan. I'll talk a bit about their lives, and then I will play a song for you called Let's Eat, and that's by them. Should be quite funny. I'm also going to be letting you know what's going on in the theatres around the Bristol area where we broadcast from, and a bit of a wider picture in theatre life as well. Let's get started. As I said, Good for the Jews consists of Rob Tannenbaum and David Fagan. Rob Tannenbaum wrote a song called It's Good to Be a Jew at Christmas, and it appeared at the 2005 Shout Factory CD, Now That Sounds Kosher. This was alongside songs by Mel Brooks, Tom Lehrer and Kinky Friedman. He earned his first theatrical credit for helping John Leguizamo write Sexaholics, which was a Tony-nominated Broadway comedy. He has been interviewed by Terry Gross of NPR for a Fresh Air segment and has performed at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal. He was even named one of New York's best emerging Jewish artists at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in 2006. He is the music editor of Blender magazine and a member of the Jewish-owned media elite. He appears frequently on a VH1 credited and starred in the VH1 special So Jewtastic. His partner, David Fagan, says that he is currently on tour with Tannenbaum because Staples isn't hiring right now. He is most famous for being in the indie pop group The Rosenbergs. He has lectured on the business of music at Harvard Law School. His songs have been heard on programmes such as Dawson's Creek, Party of Five and One Tree Hill, to name but a few. Allmusic.com held The Rosenbergs for a clever, incessantly buoyant pop sound that could compare to the brighter days of Cheap Trick. David says he hopes one day to own a hair salon in Boca called Bagels and Locks. Right, so you've heard about them. Let's hear some of their stuff. This is Good for the Jews with Let's Eat.
We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. The year was 1492. Hitler had just invaded Poland. Madonna had just become a Jew. Moses was found on the Potomac. Then he marched with Martin Luther King. He came back to free us from our bondage, 'cause S&M has never been our thing. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
Let's eat.
They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So they chased us to the border, there's a parting of the water. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
Let's eat.
Then the Pharaoh, who looked like Yul Brynner, heard the Jews were trying to escape. Charlton Heston came right down from the mountain. He said, Pharaoh, you're a damn dirty ape. The menorah was almost out of oil. Farrakhan was planning Kristallnacht. The gefilte fish was nearing extinction. It looked like Moses and his flock were fucked. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
Let's eat.
They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. And we knew how
how to resist, 'cause we'd rent a Schindler's List. Tried to kill us, we survived. Let's eat that cake.
The 10 Egyptian plagues.
1.
Blood.
2.
Locusts.
3.
Boils.
4.
Dandruff.
5.
Acne.
6.
Bacne.
7.
Piles.
8.
Cataracts.
9.
Sciatica.
10.
Sickle cell anemia.
We fled on foot. There was no time to tarry. Leavening the bread would take too long. All we had was egg bouillon and matzah, while battling the fearsome Viet Cong. And so tonight we gather to remember the ancient Hebrews who paid the price. We have a Seder each year in December to commemorate our Savior Jesus Christ. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So we never did succumb to the annual pogrom. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So come on, blow the shofar, 'cause they haven't nailed us so far. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
That was Good for the Jews there with Let's Eat. Yeah, interesting, I think you'll agree. They made their UK debut in July this year when they performed at the Leeds Jewish International Performing Arts Festival. Their website gives upcoming tour dates. However, there are no mentions of a tour extending beyond America at the moment. But for those of you who will be in America, they'll be at the JCC of Kansas City on the 22nd of November, and at Brownriggs Hiller House in Providence on March the 9th, and at DCJCC in Washington DC on March the 20th. That brings me to letting you know what else is on in the theatrical world. If you're in the Bristol area where we're broadcasting from, the Tobacco Factory is showing Oh What a Lovely War by Joan Littlewood, and that's on from the 13th till the 22nd of November. The Kelvin Players present An Evening by the Radio double bill with War of the Worlds and It's a Wonderful Life on the 9th until the 13th of December. And for those of you creative listeners out there, Untitled Theatre Company is seeking submissions for their Festival of Jewish Theatre. The festival takes place from the 20th of May until the 14th of June next year in New York City. It's being held in conjunction with the annual conference of the Association for Jewish Theatre, or AJT, and that's to be held on June the 6th through to the 10th. This is an international conference of theatre professionals in the area of producing and creating Jewish theatre. For more details, you can look on jewishtheatre.com, or you can email Edward Einhorn at theatreofideas@gmail.com. The full application for this needs to be in by the 1st of December. For any other creative listeners, if you'd like to let me know about any projects you're involved in, please get in touch with me at podcast@salamshalom.org.uk. I'd love to hear from you and tell all of our listeners about you. Next time I'll be talking about the Baraka Project. They've got a tour coming up. Those of you who have listened to Stages before may have heard some of their music. They are a Jewish, Muslim and Christian group of musicians making music together for peace. So yeah, more details about that next time, but thanks for listening and take care, and I'll speak to you soon.
Jews and Muslims talking together.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.
And that was the lovely, lovely Vicky. I love her.
Yeah, with the sounds of Inshallah. And I have to say, Good for the Jews. That was absolutely brilliant. Great lyrics. And Vicky's going to be back in the glare of the spotlight with another edition of Stages in our next podcast here on Radio Salam Shalom, podcasts@salamshalom.org.uk. And just to show how well connected we really are here, in our next podcast, we have got an interview with two real superstars. One a director, one an actress. Miriam Margolyes, who is probably one of the UK's best known character actresses, starred in all kinds of things, and has recently been on tour in the UK and the US with Wicked, that amazing stage show, and a gentleman by the name of Waris Hussein. Now, he's a film director and a TV director, but more importantly, we were talking about Doctor Who a little while ago at the start of the programme, and he was the director of the first ever Doctor Who series back in the 1960s. So an interesting man, Muslim and a Jewish actress talking together, and I caught up with him, so we'll hear from them in the next podcast.
That was very interesting. Bit of trivia there.
Oh, yes, I'm full of it.
Aren't you? I was walking down the street, actually, and I saw Vicky, who, you know, whose clip you've just heard, and I was, like, shouting, Vicky, Vicky! And she just completely walked past, and I got really offended, and then I realised that she had her headphones in, so she didn't even hear me, so...
She was probably listening to the last Radio Salam Shalom podcast.
Indeed. Oh, well, I like what you're doing there. Pete, look what he's on the board, letting it slide in. And don't forget that you can listen to it wherever you are by going onto our website, which is, Peter?
It is podcast@salamshalom.org.uk, and the main website is www.salamshalom.org.uk.
Indeedy. So that's pretty cool. And I really like that, actually, because I downloaded another post 2 weeks ago, the podcast, and I was just listening to it walking on the street, and I really liked it.
It's so cool. You've just got to watch bumping into the lamppost, haven't you? There is another way of doing it, which is if you just want to get your podcast regularly and not have to worry about going onto the site all the time, you can go to iTunes and look for Radio Salam Shalom, and you can automatically get your podcast downloaded to the comfort of your own computer.
Modern technology.
How cool is that, eh?
It's just too cool for school. All right, we've actually got something now on autism. A world-renowned expert on autism, Professor Simon Baron Cohen, he's a professor of... No, I'm going to try and pronounce it. I'm so bad at all these ologies. Psychopathology, is that it?
Very good.
I got it. At Cambridge University, where he spoke to Radio Salam Shalom's Naomi Levav and Kalsoom Bashir earlier this year as part of their Knowing Me, Knowing You series of programmes.
Our guest today is Professor Simon Baron Cohen, one of the world's leading authorities on autism. He is the author of several books on developmental psychopathology, including The Essential Difference, which stirred up controversy with its attempt to link typical sex differences in psychology with the field of autism. He is a professor of developmental psychopathology, if I can get it out, at the University of Cambridge and fellow at Trinity College, where Naomi and I joined him for a very lovely morning in his office and an interview for a special edition of Knowing Me, Knowing You. Simon, thank you so much for having us here.
It's a great pleasure to be on the programme.
Is Cambridge home for you? How long have you been here?
I've lived here since 1994. So it's become my home. It's 14 years, and I've raised my children here. But I was actually brought up in London, North London, and worked there until moving to Cambridge.
So were you born in London?
Yes, I was born in a very Jewish part of London, Golders Green. Sometimes we affectionately refer to it as the ghetto, and brought up in northwest London.
What are your earliest memories? Because you refer to it with a smile on your face, like a ghetto. Looking back on it now, how do you see it with reference to that word, the ghetto, that you used?
Well, when you grow up, you always believe that your community is the same as everybody else's. You take it as normal. But obviously, when you sort of move out of the sort of warmth of your childhood community and see other communities, you realise that there's quite a diversity out there. But for me, growing up being in a large minority of Jews felt normal. But I obviously, I've met other Jews who might have been in such a small minority that they felt very, very visible and felt very uncomfortable.
You talk about the warmth of your childhood community. What are your fondest memories of growing up in that part of London with the family and the community?
Well, family probably is a major focus for me in terms of memories. Judaism is very much about a family focus, and for me it's about festivals. And my parents were particularly keen on sort of taking the traditional festivals and being a bit experimental with them. So we would celebrate, for example, Hanukkah, but with a difference. It would be very multicultural, so friends from all different religions or ethnicities would be invited to our parties, where we weren't sticking in any rigorous way to the traditional format of, for example, saying prayers in the right way. It was very much using music, using drama to make it come alive and make it very inclusive.
Right, so you say it was very multiracial. Were you aware of having friends of different faiths or being different from yourself at that sort of early age? Because it seems that Judaism did play quite a big part of your life and sort of forming your identity from when you were quite young.
Sure. I mean, you know, I was born after the war, so I had that kind of luxury of some security. But obviously, both of my parents grew up as children during the war and had plenty of stories to tell me about their experience of anti-Semitism. So, you know, my own life, you know, was obviously influenced by the stories you hear, the history. And then meeting people from other communities, you know, you realize that there's a bit of explanation needed when you explain why you eat certain foods and you don't eat others. But luckily for me, it wasn't something uncomfortable. I wasn't the only one.
Where did your parents come from?
Well, most immediately, my father was born in the East End of London, in Whitechapel. Again, you know, it was a very sort of Jewish community, but he was evacuated to Cardiff during the war. And his grandparents came from Russia and Poland. And for my mother, she was born in Canada, and her parents came from Russia. Again, you know, there's a lot of history of migration following various waves of persecution.
Being sort of part of an immigrant family myself, I know I was told to make a lot of the opportunities that were available to me in this new country. Did that form part of your childhood from your parents' point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a tension. There's a conflict where parents who've been, you know, migrants and felt that they didn't belong want their children to feel very assimilated and to feel very much, as you say, taking advantage of opportunities. But the conflict, I think, comes from not wanting your children to move too far away from traditional ways of doing things. So on the one hand, you want them to be assimilated, on the other hand, you want them to remain a bit separate. And that tension, is just always there. I'm quite interested by the idea of a culture, whether it's Jewish or Muslim, that gets the community to sit down and reflect on, you know, sometimes in religious terms it's called sins or crimes that they've committed. And in the case of Yom Kippur, the idea that you're getting a community to collectively think about very bad things that maybe some people in the community have done and collectively support individuals to reflect and talk about it. It's a community addressing its own behaviour, thinking about how it can improve itself, both at an individual level and as a group. I just find that's a very, you know, it's a very impressive thing that you can reflect in that way.
As a child, were you always aware of the presence of a God in your life, being brought up as a Jew? At what sort of stage were you aware that you were accountable to a God for, you know, you're saying you're sort of almost atoning for humanity and the crimes that are being committed? How far back does that notion go with you?
I think I was probably brought up to believe that there was a God, and I no longer believe that, so I'm an atheist, and some people might find it puzzling that I can identify myself as Jewish and still be an atheist. But, you know, in my daily life I'm doing science, and science really is looking for explanations which are not theological, not divine, for how things work in the world. But I do identify with being Jewish from a historical perspective, a cultural perspective, a moral perspective. And I don't know that it entails, you know, a belief in God. But obviously that's not a view that would be held in the Orthodox community. So I feel much more comfortable in the Reform or the Progressive section of the Jewish community.
So it's very much about sort of maintaining a culture, an identity with traditional sort of roots, rather than this sort of form of religion that believes in a God that is all-powerful and that you are responsible to.
That's right. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that your moral behaviour can either be determined by, you know, you believe that God has told you what to do or how to live, or you can take responsibility for your own behaviour. And I think you're right that that shift towards individual agency, ultimately you are accountable for what you do, means that when you go to sit in a community service like that, the Yom Kippur service, you're not just talking to God in order to get, you know, to be forgiven for something, but you're actually thinking about what you can do to change yourself. So it's much more at an individual level.
So you still go to a synagogue?
I do. I mean, until recently, I was an infrequent attender. So I would go to the Kol Nidre service because I love the music. And again, it's part of an opportunity for cultural participation, cultural identification. You don't hear that music when you're out in the rest of the world. More recently, my mother died, and I've been going with my father to a Friday night service every week. And, you know, that's partly because the tradition is that when someone dies, you say Kaddish, which is the prayer for the dead. And again, even as an atheist, that has a very strong value to me, because it means that when someone is bereaved, they're not going through the mourning process alone. They're part of the community. And when they're saying the prayers, they don't say them alone, but actually they're in the company of 100 other voices, of people who are either friends or family who are there to support the person as they go through it. So I think there's a strong social or community benefit, if you like, to many of these rituals. That is really what empathy is all about. And it's about not just assuming that other people are going to live the same way as you, or that you can dictate how other people should live, but that you recognize other people's feelings are valid, even if they're different. And really trying to put yourself into the shoes of the other person, to imagine what it might be like to live, you know, from their side of seeing things from their side. So when we think of, for example, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, you know, at the core of it, you might say there is a greater need for empathy on both sides. And that's at a sort of at a national level, when communities need to empathize. But ultimately, it comes down to a much more individual level. So when we have, you know, a Jew and a Muslim making a program like you and Naomi are doing together, you're getting to know each other and getting to understand each other and getting to really empathize with each other. And I think that's where it starts.
You've just summed up what Radio Salaam Shalom is all about, so now we have a scientific explanation as well. Thank you so much for being our guest.
It's been a great pleasure for me, so thank you very much for inviting me.
That was part of a conversation between Salaam Shalom's Crossing Cultures team and Professor Simon Baron Cohen at Cambridge University. The full interview will shortly be available from the Radio Salaam Shalom website, so keep your eyes open for that.
And a fascinating interview it was too. Didn't talk an awful lot about autism, but that's really the purpose of the Crossing Cultures team, is to really get behind individuals, find out a bit about what makes them tick. And interestingly, here's another fascinating fact for you.
You're just full of them today.
I am. His father was born just up the road from where I was born, because I was born in Stratford in East London.
Right.
And he was born in Whitechapel, which is literally just up the road. In fact, he was probably born in the London Hospital. So there you go.
So you're neighbours.
So we're kind of neighbours. In fact, we could really be relatives. But
yeah, you know. Yeah, you could.
There we go.
Autism, I find really, really interesting. And I just quickly want to recommend a book to everybody, because I love reading and I love books. Mark Haddon, Curious Incident of a Dog in the Nighttime. Seriously, check that out, because it's one of the first books I read on autism. And although it's a fictional book, it's just such an interesting insight into autism and how people who suffer from autism, how they work. It's really interesting, so check that out. And also the title's really cool.
And it's a fascinating book, because I've read it too, and it is really very, very interesting. Now, moving on. She's now in her 80s, and Hedy Epstein was the only member of her family to survive the Nazi anti-Jewish onslaught in Germany of the 30s, because her parents managed to send her out of the country onto the Kindertransport.
Her family subsequently perished in the concentration camps, and her experiences led her to become a strong campaigner for human rights, and she supported many causes, including that of Palestinian liberation. She's been praised by some and criticised by others, and we had the chance to hear from the lady herself during a recent speaking tour of the UK. Now, earlier this month, she also visited the Radio Salam Shalom studios, where she spoke to me, and here is the first part of that conversation, in which she talks about how she was saved from the concentration camps as a young girl and escaped to start a new life away from the horrors of wartime Europe before experiencing the post-war realities for Jews and their new neighbours in the Middle East.
When Hitler came to power, I was 8 years old, and I very quickly realised that... You know, at first I thought it was just a lot of nonsense that my parents were talking about, saying they hoped Hitler wouldn't come to power. But I very quickly realized how that would adversely affect not only my parents or other Jews, but even me. I went in school, for instance, the children after a while would no longer talk to me unless they were called me a dirty Jew. I had a math teacher who was an SS man who, when he asked me questions, sometimes would point a revolver at me, which even today is still affecting me because I have problems doing simple arithmetic. But my parents very quickly realized after Hitler came to power that Germany was not a place to raise a family, and they were very anxious to leave and willing to go anywhere in the world just to get out. But there was one country they were not willing to go to, and that was Palestine, because they were anti-Zionists. And as a young child, I didn't completely understand what it means to be a Zionist or an anti-Zionist. But if my parents were anti-Zionists, then I was one too.
We'll come back to the issue of anti-Zionism as opposed to anti-Semitism, perhaps, in a minute. But you never witnessed, thankfully, the concentration camps firsthand, and that was thanks to your parents.
Right. I mean, my father was in Dachau concentration camp in 1938 after Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass. And he came back, not the father that I knew, but a very old, broken man.
And he, or they, your parents, got you out of Germany. How many of your family did, in fact, end up in the prison camps?
All my family, except I, an uncle and aunt, my mother's brother and his wife, who left in 1938, early 38, for the United States. We're the only ones who survived.
And you never saw the rest of your family again?
No. When I left in May 1939 on a kinder transport or a children's transport to England, my parents, you know, painted a beautiful picture that I would be in a big city, learn a new language, be able to go back to school again, and on, but the last sentence always was, and we will see each other again soon. I believed that. Whether my parents did, I don't know. And my parents, as well as other family members, were deported in October of 1940 to a concentration camp in what was then Vichy, France. Vichy, France collaborated with the Nazis. And in the summer of 1942, those who survived the camps in France were all sent to Auschwitz and have never been heard from again.
Now, you escaped and you came to the UK, but you ended up in the United States. How did that come about?
Well, I lived in the UK from May 1939 until July of 45. I then returned to Germany to work for the American government. In fact, I worked at the Nuremberg trial of the doctors who performed medical experiments on concentration camp inmates. And then I chose not to remain in Germany. I also did not wish to go back to England, though I did for about 10 weeks. And then in May of 1948, I came to the United States. My uncle and aunt sponsored my coming there. And that was about the same time that Israel became a state. And I had some mixed feelings about it at the time. On one hand, I was glad there was a place for people who survived to go to because perhaps they couldn't or chose not to go back to their place of origin. But on the other hand, remembering my parents' ardent anti-Zionism, I was afraid that somewhere down the road, no good would come of this. What that might be, I couldn't possibly imagine. But I was new in the United States and new things to learn and new impressions, and so Israel and Palestine were on the back burner of my interest and remained there.
Did you consider moving to Israel?
No, I never considered that. And, you know, Israel and Palestine remained on the back burner of my interest until in 1982 I received a wake-up call when I learned about the massacres in the two refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. And I needed to find out what that was about, who was responsible, who was adversely affected by this, and what happened between 1948 and 82 when I didn't pay much attention. And the more I learned, the more I understood, the more I began to speak out publicly against the policies and practices of the Israeli government and the Israeli military.
So you became a public speaker, you became a campaigner in the United States primarily, but then right. You started to travel.
Right. In 2003, I was in Palestine for the first time. And since then, I've been back each year. In other words, I've been back five times total. And many of the Palestinians that I met there asked me, when you go back home, tell the American people what you've seen and what you've experienced, because the media doesn't really convey what is really happening on the ground. And I made that commitment. And so being here on this speaking tour in Scotland, Ireland, and the UK is part of honoring that commitment.
Do you feel that the media portrays both sides fairly?
No. Just like there is an imbalance between Israel and Palestine, there is an imbalance in the media. If an Israeli child is killed, and that is a terrible, terrible thing, terrible tragedy. But when that child is killed, it's big news. But when 10 Palestinian children are killed, no one hears about that. It seems like Palestinian lives are not worth as much as an Israeli life. And they are both equally valuable. They're both human beings.
So your perception is that if an Israeli child is killed, it makes the news, whereas it doesn't if it's a Palestinian child?
Well, I can't speak for the UK. I don't live here. I'm speaking primarily about the USA.
Yes, which in itself is an interesting balance, because there are people who would say that in the UK the balance is perhaps the other way, that in fact there is criticism that from some quarters that, for example, the BBC give more coverage to the Palestinian view than the Israeli view. And this is really part of the problem, isn't it? This is part of what you're trying to establish, trying to explore.
But I mean, when I was there, I participated in a number of nonviolent demonstrations against the wall and against the settlements, against home demolitions and so on. And, you know, I just need to talk about this and tell people what I've seen and what I've experienced. And I have made every effort to always stay with Palestinian families. And that hospitality, that Palestinian hospitality, is unlike any that I've ever seen anywhere. And I always tell people right at the very beginning, I am Jewish. And I'm told, mush mushkala, you know, no problem. You know, we're not enemies.
And this is perhaps part of the issue, the fact that there is so much in common between the two cultures, between Jewish and Muslim culture, as we discuss a lot here on Radio Salam Shalom.
We're cousins.
And that is Holocaust survivor Hedy Epstein talking to me earlier this month during her recent speaking tour in the UK. Now, you can hear the rest of that interview in our next podcast, and there's more information both on Salam Shalom, www.salamshalom.org.uk, and on Hedy Epstein's own website, www.hedyepstein.com. HedyEpstein.com.
That was a very interesting interview, I found.
And it gets more interesting because she brings us up to date with her modern experiences in Palestine and Israel and in the Middle East. So an interesting lady, interesting lady.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. I quite like the difference in the media representations of the situation in the Middle East between the UK and the US of America.
Well, I think it's a fascinating issue, and one which clearly we need to explore more. But there is interesting perceptions between how the American media view the Middle East and how it's viewed over here in the UK and in other parts of Europe.
Very interesting indeed. So we look forward to the second part of that interview.
Indeed.
Right, okay, we're going to move on to hopefully a slightly more hopeful finish with Kicking It Back. DJ Phoenix and his sidekick Natural Bliss give us their take on the recent US elections with an interesting look at how it connects with Jewish and Muslim communities in the US and further afield.
Yo.
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 Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yo.
It's Phoenix.
Natural Bliss.
We're kicking it back.
Once again.
On the podcast.
In the kitchen.
Which we got bumped from last time.
Yes.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, I did discover it, didn't I, today?
Yeah, so you did, Phoenix. Why, we got amalgamated into another piece.
Yes, somehow. So it was a bit weird hearing...
Bit of a weird mix there.
Peter Brill talking with us about... Talking at the same time about Jews and Christians and stuff like that, and we're yapping away about architecture.
And then some music kicking in the background. Yeah, it was all a bit...
Bizarre.
Bizarre.
Bizarre. Anyway, this week... Well, today... This podcast, I think we decide we're going to focus on, well, the American elections. They've been and gone now.
They have indeed.
And the result is...
Drum roll, please. A couple of days too late, but you all know Mr. Obama.
It'll be quite late by the time he is, but Mr. Barack Obama. He is the first black president of the United States.
He is indeed. The 44th president... And the first black, as Phoenix just mentioned there.
And, you know, the media reaction's been massive, and public reaction's been massive.
Yes, all over.
I remember I actually crashed out on the election night. Completely.
Wow. I did not stay up to watch it, I must admit. It was a 6 o'clock in the morning job for that, and a bit tired myself.
Apparently the results came out around 2.
I did hear rumours about that beforehand, but I would have thought it would have been about 6 myself, but congratulations in any case. He's in the hot seat.
It's the ultimate hot seat. He's got all the special buttons in front of him.
Exactly, and he has been backed by a Jewish population as well. They voted for him majority. I think 77% of the Jews voted for him against 22% for the Republicans. So yes. It was a good backing from the Jews as well.
Whereas usually the Jewish lobby in America does usually go for the Republicans.
Some say, some don't. It depends on what you read there. I find articles found that they basically go for the Democrats. So.
Really?
I have indeed, yes. Just a bit of research here.
Research.
The Democrat Party has been a congenial political home for many American Jews since the era of FDR. The party welcomed them into ranks along with many blacks and urban dwellers, and its programs comported well with many values Jews cherished. The party was also seen as one that had offered help to the doomed Jews of Europe, opposed prejudice, and supported the fledgling state of Israel from enemies that boasted of its plan to destroy the state. And conversely, the Republican Party was perceived to be a WASP enclave, enclave there, in its outlook and weak on support for Israel. That was an article taken roughly a few years ago, but the main sort of issues.
I still think it's interesting because, like, the Republicans have a strong, is known, they have a strong Christian lobby.
Indeed.
And it's usually a strong Jewish lobby, but maybe that's from a certain segment in terms of financial support, maybe, from some businessmen and stuff like that.
Maybe it can be, if you dwell into a bit further, maybe that's the issue there. But in any case, Obama's got the back end of most of the Jews, and that being the Muslims as well, I suggest.
Apparently the Muslim vote was quite strong in America. Despite the fact Obama's not actually Muslim, he is Christian, but his father was raised Muslim. But in Obama's words, he he was pretty much atheist by the time him and his wife were married. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's a bit of a moot point, but I think for Muslims it's a case of we really don't want the Republicans in power. We'd rather have the Democrats.
Could be, or be that. And just pick up on a point stating Obama is actually a Christian. Now, apparently, polls suggest that 10% of Americans still think Obama is Muslim.
That's amazing.
So, you know, they don't actually know what religion he conforms to, 10% of that population there.
Some people are saying he's Jewish. Well, that was new to me. Because apparently Obama is a Jewish name, Barack is a Kenyan name.
Yeah, indeed there.
He's in power now.
He is.
Well, he will be in 2 weeks. What does he do next? Does he clean up Bush's mess? Is he going to be able to clean up Bush's mess?
Well, a lot of people say it can't really get any worse than it is at the moment. And anyway, it is up for the American government and for, you know, countries around the world that you sort of, you know, not rely but are affected by the American decisions as well there. So it can only get better, I believe. Don't expect miracles, you know, really quickly. He's just got into power, give him time. He'll do his job and just see how it goes. Give him a couple of months, a couple of years, see, you know, how it changes up. And his, you know, sort of words, change will come, his change has come, and just wait for the change to sort of materialise there.
I mean, he doesn't want to end up being Gordon Brown.
I don't think he does, no. I don't think no one does, no.
Poor Gordon.
Yeah.
Tony Blair just left a mess in the office.
Clean up, Gordon.
Clean up, Gordon. I'm off.
Cheers.
Cheers. Tally-ho.
Yeah.
Got any more snippets for us?
Just a little articles of people of Israel supporting Obama and basically appreciating the fact that he's in power. Just congratulating him and looking forward to a brighter future in Israel. And Mr. Nida states himself. They're all optimistic of what the country can be in a few years' time.
I mean, in slightly sort of opposite to that, I found it a bit odd looking at the Muslim news. Out of all the news stories they got, they had to put this one in. Rahm Emanuel, who fought for Israel during the first Gulf War, to be Obama Chief of Staff. US President-elect Barack Hussein Obama appointed Democrat Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel to be his Chief of Staff. The 40-year-old Emanuel was a key figure in the administration of former President Bill Clinton and had earlier volunteered for the Israeli Army in the first Gulf War. Now, I'd say was it important to report the fact that he is formerly worked for the Israeli Army?
Not entirely, I would say, but a news article in itself, but not the overwhelming important fact there. I'm not sure what they're trying to pick up on that. It's got Israel connections there, maybe he has, but
I mean, I can see where they're coming from. Muslims do feel like America has been hard on us and hard on Muslims and stuff like that. But I'd say having to pick out the fact that this guy is Jewish or volunteered for the Israeli army, it's not that big a deal. Right, we're going to finish the show in a slightly strange way.
Yeah, before we do, just one point I wanted to read out, which I found. Go ahead with that. State saying there is no longer any way that any white man can claim superiority, nor any black person feel discriminated. We are all the same people, and this election is a great statement to that effect.
We got the end of his speech with two quite poignant songs underneath, I think. First one's Change from Joy Den Lane, and I Have a Dream from Common and Will.i.am. Peace out.
Ann Nixon Cooper is 106 years old. She was born just a generation past slavery, a time when there were no cars on the road or planes in the sky, when someone like her couldn't vote for two reasons, because she was a woman and because of the color of her skin. And tonight, I think about all that she's seen throughout her century in America, the struggle and the progress. The times we were told that we can't, and the people who pressed on with that American freedom. Yes, we can. At a time when women's voices were silenced and their hopes dismissed, she lived to see them stand up and speak out and reach for the ballot. Yes, we can. When there was despair in the Dust Bowl and oppression across the land, she saw a nation conquer fear itself with a new deal, new jobs, a new sense of common purpose. Yes, we can. and tyranny threatened the world, she was there to witness a generation rise to greatness and a democracy was saved. Yes, we can. She was there for the buses in Montgomery, the hoses in Birmingham, a bridge in Selma, and a preacher from Atlanta who told the people that we shall overcome. Yes, we can. A man touched down on the moon. A wall came down in Berlin. A world was connected by our own science and imagination. And this year, in this election, she touched her finger to a screen and cast her vote. Because after 106 years in America, through the best of times and the darkest of hours, she knows how America can change. America, we have come so far. We have seen so much, but there's so much more to do. So tonight, let us ask ourselves, if our children should live to see the next century, if my daughters should be so lucky to live as long as Ann Nixon Cooper, what change will they see? What progress will we have made? This is our chance to answer that call. This is our moment. This is our time to put our people back to work and open doors of opportunity for our kids, to restore prosperity and promote the cause of peace, to reclaim the American dream and reaffirm that fundamental truth that out of many we are one, that while we breathe, we hope, and where we are met with cynicism and doubt and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can.
The Sounds of Change. That was the song I Have a Dream from Common and Will I Am, ending that look at the election of Barack Obama to the White House. Yes, we can.
Yes, indeed we can. And that was the Kicking It Back team, taking a slightly left field look, but a great way to end what has been our fifth podcast here on Radio Salam Shalom. And don't forget that you can listen to, in the comfort of your car, in the comfort of your living room, in the comfort of other people's living rooms, or even in the comfort of your own bath. All you need to do, podcasts at salamshalom.org.uk, or you can download it from iTunes and other good podcasting stores. Of course, it's all for free. In fact, it's all for charity. So it's been great to have you with us. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. We're going to be back again in our mid... where are we now? God, we're into December.
I know.
Can't believe it. Where's it all gone? Into our December. Well, in fact, we've got an end of November podcast to do first, so that's okay. I'm wishing the time away here.
Yes, yeah. So definitely tune in for that. I hope you guys enjoyed today's. I really did. It was nice catching up with you, Peter.
It was, and with you. We should do it more often, I think.
Yes.
It's been the Shabs and Pea Show.
Shabs and Pea Show. I like it. Well, from here in Bristol, Salam Shalom.
This is Radio Salam Shalom.